I'm happy now to welcome retired professor, historian Adrian Bustamante. He's here to talk to us about the second part of New Mexico's history, the, I guess you would call it, post-colonial period, the period where the first American arrived in the area where we are sitting right now here in Santa Fe.
Yes, I think that the early 19th century really began what some of us term to be the middle period of New Mexico's history.
What happened in 1805?
Well, an individual by the name of James Purcell and others tried to become empresarios and come into the territory that was controlled by Spain. And foreigners couldn't come in, you know, without a special passport and all that. And one of them was James Purcell. He was captured and put under house arrest because he had no passport and came to Santa Fe. He was able to keep his rifle, but no gunpowder or any balls, lead balls. And so he became a carpenter here in Santa Fe. Now, what I haven't been able to track is when he left the area, and I'm sure it's out there, but he is the first American of record to have entered New Mexico, have entered Santa Fe. A year later, of course, Lieutenant Zebulon Pike came in to Spanish territory, was captured up in the San Luis Valley, Colorado, and then brought into Santa Fe. And he kept a journal, which was taken from him, but then he began to write his journal secretly. And, of course, gave the Americans really the first view, first-hand look at the quote-unquote Kingdom of New Mexico, that it wasn't a rich kingdom, the colony, how people lived here, and really that we were really tied to Mexico. We were Mexico. And we had been since 1598 tied intimately to Mexico. Mexico was the large colony of, was called New Spain. It was a large colony of Spain. But we were part, we were the northernmost point colony in the region.
So Mexico was a colony of Spain, which eventually became an independent nation.
Yes.
In 1821, New Mexico became officially part of Mexico. What is
no,
that right?
No, not officially. Everybody became Mexico. The whole territory, our entire Southwest, from Texas through New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, a part of Colorado, Nevada, and California, that was all part of Mexico. And then in 1821, when Mexico revolted against Spain and began their own country, then that became Mexico.
So we were then officially part of a new independent country.
A new independent country. We were a new sovereignty, newly created sovereignty, but we were tied to Mexico. There was some communication, but not an awful lot. The officials came from Spain, but a lot of them, a lot of the lesser on the lower echelon of government were from Mexico.
How did life actually change for people when that governmental change happened?
The local people changed very little. The culture continued to be one of subsistence farming and also some trading. And so little changed outwardly. However, also in 1821, of course, William Becknell came in to trade. As soon as he heard that you could come and trade in New Mexico, he came with a mule pack to trade here in Santa Fe, and of course made a lot of money on the first trip. So that we look at Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Santa Fe in particular being very poor, but people had put away their money because we had the barter system. And so we traded goods and hid the money someplace. So there were, you know, quite a few pesos around that he could, that they could use to buy the goods that Becknell brought. And one of the reasons for that is that the Chihuahua merchants had a stranglehold on New Mexico trade-wise. They sold them inferior goods at a high price because they were the only source of manufactured goods. We manufactured very little here in New Mexico. So when Bagnell came in with superiorly manufactured goods, bingo, here was a way, and cheaper than you could buy them in Chihuahua. Well, here it was. The upshot of that was that New Mexico then began to look at the United States for its economic needs, for its commercial needs, and not so much to Mexico. In fact, the traders had started coming in with their wagons loaded with goods when they found out that the trade was good here in Santa Fe. They continued going on down to Chihuahua and other places, following the old caravan route that used to connect the interior of Mexico with its northernmost part, Santa Fe. And so this is what began to make the former colonists look eastward and begin to buy American material things, material goods, that began to kind of change the mind of the former colonists here, of the now Mexicans, because they took the title totally as "We are Mexicanos." Mm-hmm.
So they were Mexicanos. The Mexican period didn't last very long.
No, it didn't. And that is because two things happened. Mexico has a hard time, and I really personally don't believe that democracy can work in a poor country. Okay? It's very difficult to maintain the rule of law and so on. But they tried. They tried desperately. Finally, they begin a Republican government. And finally, that begins to evolve onto a dictatorship, where strong men begin to come in. And that's unfortunately been part of the history of Latin America, is caudillo, the strong man taking over. Well, that happened. And so that was a failure in a sense that a lot of people just did not have loyalty to their government. In fact, in 1837, they sent up because the Mexicans didn't pay taxes, didn't like paying taxes, never did. But anyway, in 1837, they had sent up Albino Perez to be governor, who was a colonel in the Mexican army. And he came in here with a strong, strong arm, saying, strong arming the people to start paying their taxes. And the people revolted. They weren't used to paying taxes. In fact, Santa Fe had been a colony supported by the Spanish government, mostly because of the missionaries, and then later the fear that America was going to take over. Well, then Texas had revolted, and the people here got very angry at Perez. First, he was an outsider. Secondly, hey, he's having us pay taxes. So anyway, to make a long story short, they revolt against him, and he is assassinated over on Agua Fria Street.
Really?
Yes, the stone is still at the Palace of the Governors, in the yard of the Palace of the Governors. So they killed him. So that tell us that there was a loose connection with Mexico, even though their identity was Mexicano. We can talk about that later. But that began to break these bonds. But then the second important element here is manifest destiny. The Americans had designs on the West Coast, on California. And so they perpetrated a war in order to be able to get the land. Mexico did not want to fight the United States. They knew they were powerless against this enormous country, strong economic and military country. But the Americans baited them until they started the war. Well, Mexico wins. Meanwhile, during the war, 1846, General Kearney comes in, colonel then general, comes in, takes over Santa Fe, and then heads on to California. The people revolted here in 1847 because they had heard so many stories about the atrocities caused by some of the soldiers, especially Tennesseans and Texans that were fighting over on the Eastern Front. And also, there was a sense here that, doggone it, Mexico is our country.
Right.
And we didn't fight because Armijo set up barriers, Governor Armijo set up barriers and so on, and brought the militia over to Cañoncito, right, close to Glorieta. And then he refused to fight. And I think two things. He may have been bribed. Secondly, he realized this is going to be useless bloodshed. So he took off. So anyway, the Americans take over. And like I said, in 1847, they revolted. By 1848, all that had been put down, and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed, which made this whole region, all those states that I mentioned earlier, became American. And so that changed Santa Fe.
So you have in New Mexico, well, going right through here, the Santa Fe Trail. Tell us a little bit about that, how it was built, when it was built, what its function was.
Okay, 1821, McNeil followed old Indian trails that had been used even by some of the colonists here to get into St. Louis, to go to St. Louis, and also down into New Orleans and so on. So there were old trails that were used especially by the nomadic tribes that would come in and trade here, first with the Pueblos, way, way back, and then in prehistoric times and even in historic times, the Comanche used them, and other tribes. So he followed that, and that opened that trail for commerce, because he's the first one to come in and trade from a foreign nation, the United States, and that opened it. And that, of course, goes through the panhandle of Oklahoma, then into Kansas, and then Kansas into Missouri. And that became the trade, one of the great trails. And it was a commercial trail, not so much an immigrant trail as was the Oregon Trail, but it was a trade trail.
So even early on, Santa Fe saw a lot of things from other places.
Yes, yes. And this was really the beginning of it. This was really the beginning of it, 1821, when they began to bring in all of the American goods, the American wagons. Some French trappers had been here in the late 1700s, but this brought in other trappers and so on. So you're right, they began to see other individuals, and some stayed here, others moved on. But you can imagine the plaza being a place full of wagons when a caravan came in, and then the merchants around here flocking over to see who was going to make the best deal for which wagon. And then the governors did tax those wagons by the wagon load, and then began to sell it to the public or load it on other wagons and head down to Chihuahua, those lagos and other trading places on the what is called now the Chihuahua Trail. So yes, that began this mix and began to make Santa Fe this interesting town that it is, multicultural, multi-ethnic.
Right.
And so on. So people kind of got used to that.
Yeah, I mean, the influence, it's one of many examples, and we see them in the present day, of the influence of commerce and just simply commercial goods on the culture of a faraway place. So we are here in Santa Fe, here in northern New Mexico. We are American Indian. We are all sorts of different Europeans. We are Spanish, which is another European, mixtures of all those things. And identity and how we identify ourselves and how we've identified ourselves in different places is always a conversation.
Very much so, because we need to understand that ethnicity is effervescent, and ethnicity depends on what badge we want to wear. And speaking of almost all human beings on Earth, but that mix with other cultures, that are in proximity with other cultures. But the New Mexicans, the Hispanos in New Mexico, are quite a group ethnically. Spain itself was mixed layer upon layer, each generation or every 100 years or so, or 500 years, 1,000 years. It itself is multi-ethnic.
With the Arabic influence.
The Arabic influence, but they mixed a lot with the early tribes that came to the peninsula. And of course, the Ice Age, the Second Ice Age, has a lot to do with this, in the sense that half of Spain had to be vacated, and then the ice melted, and the people went back. The ones that came down from Norway and Denmark and so on started trekking up into those regions again when there was no more ice. Well, a lot of people stayed. The Basques, ethnic group, they survived the Ice Age in their caves during that, with 100 feet of ice above them or something like that. They stayed there.
Wow.
The rest moved, down to southern Spain and other places. Anyway, what I'm describing here is, if you look at a map of Spain, prehistoric Spain, it's made up of an awful lot of tribes all over the place. Well, that group, even during the time of West Goths, the Visigoths that came in, they then started setting up little petty kingdoms. that made it very easy, and fought among themselves, made it very easy for the Arabs to come in. They bring in their culture, which is how you deal, how you survive. I think that the main thing they brought was, how do you survive well? How do you live well in an arid area such as southern Spain? Well, they brought in acequias, or ditches, agricultural products, plants, and so on that had never been brought into that part of Europe, and so they, there goes this mix. Then they come to Mexico, for our purposes, conquer the Aztecs in Mexico with the help of a lot of tribes who hated the Aztecs because the Aztecs were dictatorial and a very, very cruel bunch. Those are the beliefs in the days, you know, you could sacrifice a warrior and take over other people. Anyway, they had an empire. Okay, that collapsed under Spanish and Tlaxcalan and other groups under their might. So Cortes led them, but it was also a lot of support for the Native Americans. The Spanish come in, and they don't bring that many women with them. So, you know, either they have what the church used to call illicit liaisons, or they marry Indian women. A lot of them are searching for royalty. Okay, if I marry an Indian princess, an Indian Inca or Aztec princess, then I'll have royalty, and everybody was looking for hidalgues and so on. The upper crust wanted to continue. Anyway, so there was a big mix among the people themselves. Now, the best figure that I can find as to what percentage of the colonists that came to the New World, well, let's say to Mexico specifically, is probably 18%. I'm still researching that because I'm writing about this. 18% of all of those colonists, 250,000, whatever, is not very much. So they had to be an awful lot of mixture with the natives. In fact, by the time of Vargas, when he sent down some of his lieutenants to recruit colonists to come up, they called the colonists that came up Españoles Mexicanos, already with that stamp of being Mexican. But I find then what Spain did was to try to classify these mixtures that were taking place. They couldn't understand them, and they wanted to define them, and of course were great at classification. So, you know, we humans love to classify things. Well, they began to classify a person by the mixture that he had. First, Spanish blood, how much Spanish blood, how much Native American blood, and then the blacks came in. They had come in as slaves, and when Mexico outlawed slavery and the Spanish frowned upon it, but still it still had to continue to happen in the colonies. Who was coming over to enforce it? You know, no one, but even though the laws were there. Because at the time of Coronado, Indian slavery had been banned. But like I say, the enforcement was weak. Same thing happened with the blacks. By the 1770s, there were probably 60,000 blacks in Mexico. Well, they began to mix. And so Spain then begins to classify, and they come up with about 30 terms that could be used to classify all of these people.
I saw that in one of the articles that you wrote. It's almost crazy. If somebody, if this kind of person mixes with that kind of person, you know, A plus B equals C, C plus A equals D, D,
it fascinates me also. I mean, it's just fascinating. Because how do you do that? In fact, here in Santa Fe during the 1790 census, they classified people as color quebrado, broken color. Because they knew, looking at the person, all the physiognomy was dark and so on, and the guy probably started saying, or the woman started saying, well, let's see, my mother was a mulatta, my father was this, his mother was that, blah, blah. And the guy probably says, thank you very much, and then just wrote broken color and went on to the next one. I mean, you can't figure it out. You're right, it's absurd. They did create some beautiful paintings that tell us in a very stylistic way what people were wearing and, you know, how they looked upon those people. The other thing was the competition to go from a mulatto, let's say, half black, half Spanish, and so on, to rise all the way up to being an Espanol, a Spaniard. Well, if you were successful in business, had enough money, and enough political pull, you could change your identity. And this is what I meant by ethnicity being so effervescent. It can change depending on the situations.
So you're not absolutely locked in by race?
No, and we aren't. In fact, the new research, DNA research, is telling us race, the concept of race, is a cultural construct. It's a human construct.
And it always sort of amuses and puzzles me. We're almost out of time, but what people mean when they say la raza.
La raza, that means Hispanics from here. And then they tie in, of course, their mestizo background, their Indian Spanish background.
But when you think of all the races that go into the mixture that makes us la raza, or makes somebody else la raza and me not, or you not,
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly. And that's because we're always looking for a comfort level in culture where we want to identify ourselves, you know, with the culture that we kind of belong to, and we begin to set up these mythical classifications. We're all human, and we need to start, we need to realize that. And this is why a while ago I discussed how Spain was formed from so many other groups that came into that peninsula. It continued here in the New World. And so a lot of people that La Raza, for example, has tried to emphasize the fact that they are a mixture of many groups. Those that want to be only Spanish American say, no, we're Spanish. Well, there are a lot of Spanish traits in what we have, including language and a lot of our foods and so on. But a dark-skinned individual in Mexico with a Spanish name that has any one ancestor or two ancestors that are European can claim to be Spanish. He's got an ancestor in Spain. So it's a complex issue. It's a very sensitive issue. And once it gets into the realm of the emotions, forget it. You're not going to convince people. I'm La Raza. I am Spanish-American. I'm Anglo-American. Anglos don't like that term, so some of us use Euro-Americans. So
right. It's, and what's unfortunate about it is it's often a way to divide us from each other.
Exactly. And that's what I have against it, is we try to set up these parameters and don't allow anybody in. It's all for our benefit or because we've been slighted or hurt. And that has been brought up because of these divisions. And so they try to get out from under pejorative terminology, you know, all of this kind of business. Yes, you're right.
Adrián Bustamante is a historian. He's a retired professor of history. Thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And let's continue the conversation one of these days.
Well, thank you, Mary. I'd be glad to. And thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're streaming at ksfr.org and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.